Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. The exhibition Winslow Homer, Making Art, Making History is currently on display at the Clark Art Museum in Williamstown, Massachusetts through September 8th. It features more than 200 works by Homer, spanning his career and including paintings, watercolors, drawings, etchings, lithographs, chromolithographs, wood engravings, photographs, correspondence, and books. I went to the Clark yesterday to view the exhibition with a special, and if the museum's attendee response is any indication, coveted, tour with Michael Kassin, the director of the Clark Center for Education in the Visual Arts.
Which basically means I do lectures and run courses and work with audiences and interpretation of various kinds.
And take radio producers around on audio tours of exhibitions.
Absolutely, that's one of the pleasures of the job.
Thank you again for taking the time. We're looking today at the Homer exhibition.
People may know that we have a very wonderful collection of Winslow Homer works here at the Clark Art Institute, and a lot of people will know the oil paintings because they tend to be on show rather more than some of the other works on paper, for example. But we have not only the oil paintings, we have fantastic collections of his early wood engraving illustrations for Harper's Weekly. We have etchings by Winslow Homer. We have a fantastic and really, really spectacular selection of watercolors by Winslow Homer, which of course don't often get put on the wall because they're very delicate and rather sensitive to light. And so it's really great to have this opportunity to include works not only from his entire career as a painter, but across all the media that he worked in and all the different types of imagery that he made. It's a great exhibition opportunity for us to display this whole range of things. So the exhibition really starts in the middle of the 1850s when Homer was in his teens and early 20s. And when he started working as an illustrator for a publishing company, there are a couple of very interesting little images which he produced as sheet music covers. So that's where the exhibition really starts. And then it looks very extensively at the range of images that he produced for journals, Harper's Weekly, etc., etc. And we have many, many of those. In fact, the first impression people get if they come up the stairs and turn left to enter the exhibition is this whole wall full of fantastic wood engraving prints. So it's a real kind of wow moment, you know. The exhibition then goes through a sequence of other rooms which explore not only his product as an artist, but also how people over the years since his lifetime have interpreted the pictures. And so the exhibition's called Winslow Homer, Making Art, Making History. And it's really about how people might look at these pictures, not only how an artist might think and develop over the years, but also how people might interpret them both as works of art, both as beautiful things and images, but also how they might interpret them as pieces of evidence that relate to social history and the times that the artist lived through and how society changes during that period. And of course, Winslow Homer, working from the mid-1850s right the way through to 1910, lived through some pretty momentous times.
Let's go in, shall we? You mentioned this first striking wall is wood engravings, and there's several of them, and they are absolutely stunning.
Well, Winslow Homer worked, as I said, as a kind of freelance visual journalist. He produced drawings which were then turned into wood engraving prints, which were then printed with texts for journals like Harper's Weekly. And as you can see, we've got a number of the cover images here with the Harper's logo at the top. Really, these images relate to a whole range of contemporary activities, the kinds of life that people lived in the 1860s when he was making most of these things for publication. And so they deal with extremely idyllic, lovely little, you know, pleasant pastimes like kids playing with each other, kids fishing on a seesaw over there. Sitting under a tree, you know, shading themselves from the sunlight, playing ball, that kind of thing. But they also include very different images, like people digging themselves out of a blizzard. They include references to the Civil War. You can see on this sequence here, there are two very famous images side by side, one which shows you a cavalry charge and one shows a bayonet charge. And he made those in the 1860s during the war. He was actually sent by Harper's as a kind of image journalist to report on some of the activities, some of the maneuvers, some of the active battle scenes, but also some of the scenes of behind the scenes. So there are scenes of surgeons working in tents and things like that. But they're very powerful things. And one of the things that I think he was quite keen to try to suggest was, although these are drawn, They may not actively have been drawn from life. You know, I'm not trying to suggest that he was sitting there watching the cavalry charge as it was happening, but they very definitely preserve a very powerful flavor of what it must have been like to be there live. And in that sense, they are almost like the kind of precursors of contemporary photojournalism. They're really very clever, and they're composed of drawings, from drawings that he would have done on the spot. And, you know, he did a lot of drawings, a lot of sketches of soldiers sitting around the camp. You know how people always say that life in an army camp is bursts of activity interspersed with lots of sitting around. And I think he captures exactly those two extremes in some of these really great images. But he also deals with the activities of people who are not involved directly in the war, but who are at home keeping society going. So there are very wonderful images, for example, of young women sitting around making havelocks, making those things that people probably know from Beaugest movies, you know, the kind of handkerchief that hangs down the back of a cap to protect your neck from the sun. And so there are images of the war, images of the soldiers when they're fighting and not fighting, but also images of people making life as normal as possible during this really rather traumatic period.
What shall we look at next?
I think the next thing would be to go and have a look at the other big wall that we have in here, which introduces people to some of these threads that we've been talking about. So, I could see your eyes lit up as we came in here. That's a nice thing to see. The first wall included a very powerful display of lots and lots of images to demonstrate the range of the collection and of his activities. But this wall, it's arranged in a series of horizontals and vertical images, a little bit like the kind of way you see words in a crossword puzzle. And the idea is that if you look along the center one, you'll see that's called the Civil War. You'll see a whole range of images that he made that connect with themes to do with the Civil War. But crossing that vertically, you see a sequence of images called Women, and they're about the lives of women in the 1860s, and there is a crossover image which deals with the lives of women during the Civil War. So you get a sort of composite thread of how these images weave together.
And then there's also economics and class and music and dancing. This is really magnificently put together. Who's responsible for the setup?
The exhibition was curated by Mark Simpson, who is the associate director of the graduate program that's run jointly by the Clark Art Institute and Williams College. And he's been very involved in researching Winslow Homer's work for many, many years. He's a deeply learned guy who knows all about these things. And he's arranged these things both as reflections of Winslow Homer's art career, but also as explorations of how the social history might be teased out of them. My particular favorite thing in this room, if you don't mind me picking a favorite.
Of course not.
Is this picture here. This is one of the famous images. It's an image that many people will know from reproductions and from cards. There are two oil paintings that are similar in composition. But this is a wood engraving print called Snap the Whip, and it's a very famous picture of a little red schoolhouse with boys and girls, I'm glad to say, playing in the recess. They're actually playing a game which involves, you know, twirling around each other and at some point flying off at the end of the line.
Right.
And that's what you've got in this image. And what I think is so great is during the 1860s and 70s, after the war, Winslow Homer has this series of images which explore a rather more idyllic existence, you know, where people feel more secure, they don't feel anxious about the distress that happened during the war, and they're optimistic images. It's not that they're nostalgic particularly, and they're not sentimental, but they engage in a very wonderful sort of nostalgia, which isn't sentimental. They actually look back at youth and childhood and pastimes that are innocent and pleasurable that people can still pursue today.
Where do we go from here?
If we go this way through, we'll get to a room which houses most of the oil paintings. This wall over here to my left is an interesting display with just two of the Clark's most famous oil paintings by Homer. One is an early picture from the 1860s, and next to that is a picture that I know a lot of people would recognize. The first picture is called The Bridle Path, and it shows a solitary woman on a white horse riding through the White Mountains in New Hampshire, and she's part of a kind of vacation group. There are other riders both ahead of her and behind her, but Winslow Homer has separated her and her horse from the other figures, and she's not only the center of the image, she's almost isolated within her own thoughts. It's not mm-hmm. just that she's physically separated, but she seems very involved in her own thoughts. She's being very meditative and very thoughtful. There's a figure behind her, coming up behind her on the pathway through the mountains, who seems to be waving a handkerchief to attract her attention. And she's either willfully ignoring him or hasn't noticed him yet. She's very definitely sort of concerned to think her own thoughts. It's a really, really wonderful image, I think, which again could be interpreted by social historians as something that demonstrates not only the new possibility of leisure activities and vacations in the countryside, but also the new feelings of independence that women experienced after the Civil War. As you know, anybody who saw Gone with the Wind, you know, we know that Scarlett O'Hara stayed at home and kept the woodyard going, and that was a kind of independence that people were not surprisingly unwilling to relinquish after the war was over. The second picture is a picture called Two Guides, and it shows two wilderness guides in the Adirondacks. It's a recognizable location. What he's done is actually conflate a couple of different locations and moved the guides from where they normally hang out and put them in this particular location, which is very spectacular and recognizable. But it's a great scenic image which celebrates the openness and the fabulous countryside in the Adirondack region. But it also connects with human beings interacting with the great outdoors, which is something that he was very fond of doing himself. He was a great hunter and a fisherman, and he spent many, many visiting the Adirondacks and Quebec and the rural sort of wilderness areas in the Northeast. But the interesting thing about the picture is it's also got other themes going on. There's an older guide who's very heavily bearded, and he seems to be pointing something out to a younger colleague as if he's passing on a kind of folklore, a kind of tradition from one generation to another. And there's also interesting little subtleties, like they both have axes which catch the light in a very particular way. And if people look very carefully at the picture, they'll begin to see, in among the foliage, they'll begin to see some felled trees and some tree stumps. And so it looks like it's actually wilderness, but in fact there are hints of the fact that it's controlled wilderness. It's an environment which is shaped by the activity of the human beings, both who visit it and who work there to maintain it.
The clouds behind the mountains, absolutely remarkable.
Oh, the light in the picture is remarkable. And what's so cool about it is he's actually placed the figures neither in bright sunlight nor in shadow. They're almost half against the light, so the light catches them just from one side and it picks out a bit of the guy's red shirt, and little fabulous details like the shine on the blade of the older guy's axe and the handle of the axe held by the other guy peeping out in space towards us. Come and have a close look. You see the tree trunks and the fell trees over here.
Oh, right.
But you see there's a little bit of white just on the axe head, and this picks out the handle over here. And it's really, I think, a very, very ambitious thing for a painter to do, to have this fabulous scenery with the light and the clouds and the dispersing clouds at different layers over the tops of the mountains, but also to include this fabulous array of autumnal colors, these beautiful rich reds against the green hills. It's a great picture. One of the other things that people know about Winslow Homer is that he had this great affection for the sea, and as well as painting pictures of the Adirondacks and other inland areas, he also became passionate about trying to make images of the natural world, the coastline, which are not only powerful images of the coastline and the actions of the waves and the cascading waters surging around the rocks, but they also involve human interaction in a similar kind of way. And they are often to do with how human beings and the natural world either interact or try to find a comfortable balance with each other. And sometimes nature seems to be gaining the upper hand, and sometimes human beings seem to be gaining the upper hand. There's often an element of struggle there, which people, I think, have interpreted as being a very powerful addition of drama to the images. This picture, for example, Undertow, is an image that he made after having apparently witnessed something like the event that appears in the picture. He was near Atlantic City at a certain point, and he saw on the Jersey shore, he saw a rescue of a couple of figures. You can see in the center of the picture, there are two women who are wearing quite voluminous and probably rather heavy bathing dresses. And they've been taking the sea air, they've been doing something which they thought of as being healthy, and again, it's a relatively new thing for people to be able to do at this point. And sad thing is, they've got into trouble because there's an undertow, there's a current that they don't know about, and you can see there's this wonderfully luminescent, dark blue wave about to break over them. And I think what's happened is, they've been caught by the undertow, they've been soaked to the skin, their dresses have soaked up all the seawater, and they've been knocked over by the power of the waves, and the dresses have become so heavy, it's been rather difficult for them actually to rescue themselves. But fortunately, there are a couple of other people around who have waded in the water to help them out. Sometimes people think the figure on the left is heading in a slightly confusing direction. It looks like he's walking into the wave rather than trying to get out of the wave, but I think partly the reason for that is I'm no wave expert and I wouldn't know, but I suspect what he's probably doing is letting the wave break over him rather than trying to
fight
risk
it.
Rather than trying to fight it. One other thing that people may not know at first glance when they look at a picture is that Winslow Homer had, before painting this picture, he'd spent about 20 months or so in England, and he had some time during that trip. In fact, he spent most of the time during that trip in a village on the northeast coast of England, a village called Cullercoats. And we'll go and see a picture from Cullercoats in a minute. But he became very interested in the lives of the fishing community, the people who went out in the boats. But even more than that, I think he became very powerfully affected, and he had a great sympathy for the lives of the women who stayed at home and who not only mended the nets and repaired all the fishing equipment, but who actually, as we said before, who kept life going and who stoically wait for the boats to come back in the hope that they'll come back safely. And sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. Having said that about undertow, I think that leads us nicely to the picture called Saco Bay, which is over here, which shows two members of the fishing community on the coast of Maine. And they are silhouetted against a kind of sunset. There's a little hint of a boat on the horizon, but these two women are the same color as the rocks on which they're standing. And I've always felt that obviously is an accidental, and I've always personally thought that they seem to be hewn out of the rock, as if they have the same kind of permanence and the same kind of solidity. And like the rocks, they might be buffeted by the waves and the action of the water. But in fact, they are stoical. They will survive. They will actually come through it all. And they will certainly at least, they're almost like monuments to themselves, monuments to the members of the community that they belong to, carved out of the rock itself. So we have other great landscapes, West Point, Prout's Neck, Eastern Point, Prout's Neck. And over on the far wall are two little pictures that are also very exciting in terms of his personal relationship with them. The bottom one shows a fisherman in a canoe, and that's interesting because he painted it originally in the 1870s, and then subsequently he revisited the canvas and really changed the tone of it and the light in it, and he even changed the shape. Originally it was a kind of rowing boat, and then he added little corners to it, so it's now a kind of American canoe.
And how do we know that happened?
If you let your eyes tune in, you can see that underneath the sort of pink cream color in the sky, there are hints of blue. The sky originally was, I think, rather bluer.
Mm-hmm.
But in particular, you can see two very clear alterations. You can see in the corners of the boat, originally it was a different curve, and he's extended the curve with two little triangular sections, two gray areas.
I can see that.
And it's really great when you actually get a personal view of the artist's mind at work, you know, deciding to change the shape. And you can actually really see that. You don't actually need somebody like me to tell you these things. Those things are told to you by the picture themselves, which I think is really cool.
Well, it doesn't hurt to have your help.
Well, that's very kind. The picture on the top is a particularly stunning, dramatic image, which was painted in the 1890s. But it's a picture that he never exhibited in public, and it isn't signed or dated. And I don't know whether it had a very personal meaning for him or whether he thought of it as a kind of exploratory image, a kind of experiment. But it's a picture called The Sleigh Ride, and it's a rather dramatic slope. And the bottom half of the slope is a snow-covered hill with tracks from a sleigh. And the top half is a very deep blue. And the sleigh is just disappearing over the crest of the hill. We see two people and the horse, two people wrapped up against the weather. One tiny little touch of red to suggest the scarf of one of the figures in the sleigh. But they're just about to disappear over the crest of the hill, and in this dark, rather foreboding sky, there is this incredible blast of moonlight just filtering through and illuminating the tracks of the sleigh and the surface of the snow. It's a really powerful, dramatic image. And I don't know about you, but it always makes me think of things like Ethan Frome, you know, the story that everybody has to read in school.
Edith Wharton. And there's also two birds.
Yes, there are a couple of rather foreboding-looking dark, I imagine they might be crows. I don't know whether crows actually fly at night, but I think they certainly lend a certain sense of drama to the picture.
Absolutely.
Let's move on. We talked a little bit about his visit to Colour Coats in the 1880s, and I said he was very powerfully affected by the lives of the fishing community there. And he also, as I said, was a very accomplished watercolourist. And this is a watercolour called Perils of the Sea that he made in 1881 during his stay in northeastern England. And it's a perfect example of what we were talking about before. It's two female figures, again, wrapped against the elements, their shawls blowing in the wind. And they're standing in front of a nautical building, basically. It's we think it's probably the watch house for the local lifeboat crew. And there are a group of figures down at the bottom, male figures, older male figures down at the bottom, pointing out to sea, looking rather anxious about the weather conditions. And the two female figures are also looking in the same direction. And they are, like the figures in Saco Bay, they are stoically waiting for the boats to come home in the hope that the weather won't affect them rather traumatically. In the 1880s, when he was back in the USA, later in the decade, he started making etchings. And this room includes a selection of the etchings that he produced during that decade. He clearly thought that the watercolour of Perils of the Sea was a very powerful and dramatic image, and he turned it into an etching about 7 years later. And instead of just doing a straight copy, which many other people might have done, he's taken the opportunity to explore the etching medium and to make alterations to the watercolour image to make it into an even more powerful and striking, dramatic etching. The darks are darker. He's taken away the railing, which makes them look more vulnerable and more precarious, and he's altogether accentuated the contrast between the dark shadows that the figures are bathed in and the powerful white that suggests the surging waters of the sea. The North Sea is a pretty scary place, and so he's captured some of that drama, I think, very beautifully.
And on the outside of the image itself, what's on the bottom here?
Well, come and have a closer look, and you'll see there's an anchor that's just been added down at the outside. It's not necessarily connected with the image itself, though obviously it's a nautical image, so an anchor isn't wholly out of place. But this head wearing a sou'wester, this bearded man's head wearing a sou'wester, is repeated in the etching, and if you see, he comes from the watercolour as well. And he's facing one direction in the watercolour, and the same direction at the bottom of the etching, and he's turned around in the main etching itself. That happens, obviously, if you translate a painted picture into a print. When the print gets printed, it gets turned laterally inverted.
So we've got some sort of Homer practice doodles here?
Well, I don't know that they're doodles. I think sometimes those things were included as doodles, and sometimes they were intended to be removed before the print was actually editioned and sold commercially. But sometimes they were included as kind of interesting exploratory details.
I see.
But I think you'll see, if you look at the two of them, if you stand back and see both images together, you'll see that the watercolour is really dramatic and rather powerful. And the way he's enhanced that drama by turning it into an etching means, I think, it's a really great comparison, because you see the power of the watercolour and the drama of the etching medium that adds to that sense of foreboding. And simply having the two of them together is a major coup, you know? We talked about his watercolours. Should we go and see some watercolours? We've seen one here from Colour Coats. Let's go and see some others.
Sounds good.
So we're now in the room which contains a fantastic array of watercolours. And we said when we first met that oil paintings stay on the wall pretty consistently. But watercolours, because they're very delicate and because they're sensitive to the light, they have to have a rest between display. Uh-huh. And so this exhibition has given us a perfect opportunity to get the watercolours out of their light-tight boxes and to put them on the wall for people to see. And I think many people are very excited to see such an array of watercolours. Again, like the prints, like the photographs, like the drawings, from the whole range of his career. So we have two very lovely little watercolours of female figures, one of them looking for eggs, one of them tending a kind of rose bower as an allegory of summer. Painted in the 1870s, two very direct, very innocent-looking images. But as the display goes around the room, you'll see him exploring different themes like interacting with the water, going fishing, playing, like the kids playing and bathing, and pausing between agricultural, you know, feeding the cows, etc., etc. But over here, we've got another Colour Coats picture. These are figures waiting on the beach, in front of the beached fishing boats, again, looking out to sea, not quite as dramatic as we saw in the Perils of the Sea picture. You can see the weather is a little more benign here, and so I think they feel a little more confident that the boats will get home safely. But this picture is a great example of, you know, how you have a lot of work to do while everybody else is doing their thing out on the water, but how also there's a lot of waiting around as well. And so we have, I can only assume, a fisherman's family here, some little girls with an infant on her back, sitting patiently on the fishing baskets waiting for the boats to come back. And later on, there are splendid, dramatic pictures of fishing scenes, hunting scenes. There's a great vertical watercolour here called The Eagle's Nest, which is interesting, and apart from the fact that it's a great image, it's interesting because, in fact, it's not an eagle's nest, it's an osprey's nest. And we have a hunter and a local guide, a bit like the guys we saw in the two guides in the earlier oil painting. They've pulled their little canoe up, and they're sort of creeping up, admiringly looking at the nest on this rather sort of stark, dead-looking tree. But this wall over here shows a few of the other fishing scenes. In the center, a picture called An October Day, which is also from an Adirondack location.
It certainly looks like it is.
Yeah. You can see the lakes are incredibly wetly painted. You get a really great sense of how this deer is swimming across the lake, and the hills are rising behind the trees along the lakeside. But it's flanked on either side by two fishing pictures, and they're very dark in terms of the sea and the background, but they're very vibrant in terms of the light as well, and you get this incredible, beautiful sheen on the fish as they rise out of the water. The one on the right is a Quebec picture. It's an image which I've always thought was, again, a really powerful one, but also I can't help but look at this and think, I wonder if it's like one of those fisherman's jokes, you know, like there's this huge fish floating, leaping out of the water against very tiny-looking fishermen and canoe guides down at the bottom. And the fish is so much larger than the figure and the figures in the boats, it's almost like this is the one that got away, you know. You remember when we first came in, we talked about how the exhibition is called Making Art, Making History?
I do.
The last room of the show brings us full circle, because as well as showing all these fantastic finished watercolours that were not done as sketches, they were intended to be finished paintings in watercolour. But we also get another little insight to how an artist works and how an artist's mind works, because as well as the finished watercolours, we also have a watercolour sketch which really shows you Winslow Homer making art. Come on and have a look. This is a wonderful figure study on loan from a private collection, and it shows you a guy with his waders on, and he's all equipped for engaging with the great outdoors. Mm-hmm. And it's the kind of image that Winslow Homer would have made as a sketch to record the body language, the pose, the equipment, some of the setting. But he would then have used these pieces of information as the kind of raw material from which to make the finished pictures that we've been looking at in the other parts of the room.
Michael, thank you so much for showing me around this exhibition. It's been enlightening and very enjoyable.
It's been my pleasure. Always is. We hope to see you again soon.
Winslow Homer, Making Art, Making History will be at the Clark in Williamstown, Massachusetts through September 8th. Michael Kasson is the director of the Clark Center for Education in the Visual Arts. To learn more, visit clarkart.edu. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.